I was talking to the dog about global warming, but he wasn't very interested. "I could tell you what I think," he said, "but who's going to take notice of a dog? I'd rather go to the park." "Okay," I said. "We'll go to the park." People think it's weird the way I talk to Hodges. That's the dog's name. I call him that after Johnny Hodges, a sweet man with a sad face who played sweet and sad music in Duke Ellington's band. The dog has a sweet, sad face, so it made sense. Some people find that interesting, but not many. What they don't understand is that dogs are smarter than people. An old blind friend once explained it to me. "I've got a guide dog," he said. "That dog understands 90% of what I say to him, but I only understand 10% of what the dog says to me. Therefore, who is the smarter? The dog, by some considerable distance." So, let it be clearly understood, Hodges is much smarter than I am, and when he says he wants to go to the park, he knows exactly why. It's so we can both get back in touch with our primeval roots. You and me, we're hunter-gatherers. You do the hunting, I do the gathering. Of course, I don't actually hunt anything when we get there. There are ducks and swans on the lake and rumours of small freshwater fish, but they're all council property and not to be hunted. Hunting is strictly prohibited, though there are no signs saying so. It's more or less taken for granted. What we hunt is an old tennis ball. Not that I've ever played tennis. Hodges found it in the park one day, gathered it, without my having gone to the trouble of hunting in the first place. A good arrangement. It isn't one of those yellow tennis balls you see on television. It's old and grey and balding, a bit like me, though I don't smell as bad. Hodges says it could be the ball Fred Perry used to win the third of his Wimbledon titles in 1936, but I told him that was wildly romantic. "Suit yourself," he said. The procedure has a classical simplicity. I throw the ball and Hodges fetches it. We do this many times over until one of us gets tired. Well, let's be honest, until I get tired. Then I sit down on one of the memorial benches. The park has a lot of these. Benches put there in memory of people everyone's forgotten about. As a matter of historical fact, the park was given to the town by a Victorian industrialist who made a lot of money exploiting the local workforce. By giving us a park, he assumed we'd let him off the exploitation and remember him with affection, but we didn't do either. I sat down on Lillian Hardacre's memorial bench. She lived from 1896 to 1962 and was remembered lovingly by Harold, the boys, and her friends at the canning factory. Whether she is still remembered, there's no way of telling. Hodges lay down at my feet. "You're out of condition," he said. "I don't have to be in condition," I said. "I'm retired, and I'm in condition mentally. I'm now going to do my crossword." "Three letters, rhymes with rat, sits on mat," said Hodges. "Stop being cute," I said. "Doesn't go with your sweet, sad face. Besides, this is a cryptic crossword for grown-ups. It stops my brain from rotting as I enter the third age." "Wow," said Hodges. "Albert Einstein lives." The woman must have heard us talking. She stopped, looked at Hodges, looked at me and said, "Sorry to intrude, but do I know you?" "I don't know," I said. "It depends who you think I am." "Is it all right if I sit down?" she said. "Go ahead, I'm sure. Lillian Hardacre wouldn't mind." The woman sat down, turned and looked at me in a "I know something you don't know" kind of way, like builders do when they're going to tell you you need a new roof. "I'm sure you used to be somebody," she said. "Oh, I did. I was going to be a contender. I was going to be the first northerner on the moon. I was going to play for England at cricket and football. I was going to find a cure for premature baldness. I was going to be world snooker champion. I was going to write a great novel in the style of D.H. Lawrence about the corruption of this town by the capitalist hyena who later gave us this park. And, in my spare time, I was going to lead the greatest swing band since Duke Ellington's. Did you do any of those things? No, obviously not. It would have been in the papers. What did you do? I taught technical drawing at the Poly, till they turned it into a university, and then they didn't need technical drawing anymore, so I took the redundancy money and bought the dog. She looked at Hodges. There was quite a lot of change, I said, and Hodges gave me a look. The woman gave me a look too and said, "But before all that happened, you went to the Sir Francis Randall Grammar School." I owned up. I had indeed gone to the Francis Randall. Randall was another man who had given great service to the town in the 19th century, though nobody could remember what it was he did. In any case, we always referred to the place as the Frank Randall High, in honour of our great northern comedian, probably the rudest ever to tread the boards. Much ruder than Max Miller. Miller was famously banned by the BBC. Frank wasn't even allowed near enough to the BBC to be banned. They heard him coming, probably, because of the explosive and existential burps, which were a central part of his act. The heart of the matter is this. If you went to the Randall School, you didn't forget it in a hurry. As our headmaster, a gifted but harmlessly deranged man called Dr. Latimer, once said when he caught us smoking in the cycle sheds, "This school combines elements of Eton College, a carry-on film, and the Spanish Inquisition, but someone on the committee got the proportions wrong." All that being so, meeting someone who had also been to the school implied a deal of shared knowledge, secrets, and neuroses. We knew things nobody else could possibly know. We had been in the belly of the beast. "But you don't remember me, do you?" said the woman. I had to confess I didn't. "That Thursday afternoon in the library." Again, I had to confess, I didn't remember her, the library, or the Thursday. "Did I do something terrible? Do I owe you an apology? Do I need to call a lawyer?" "You changed my life." Oh, this was a big one. Hodges, who had fallen asleep on my feet, woke up and started paying attention. He was sniffing adolescent guilt in both nostrils. "I hope I changed it for the better," I said. "Absolutely." "Would you like to share this?" I said, sounding like I'd strayed into an encounter group by accident. She told me the story. "I was hiding in the library at morning break, in that little section in the corner furthest away from the door where they kept modern English literature. Nobody ever went there, and you turned up." "Did I? I don't remember." "You were looking for D.H. Lawrence." "Did I find him?" "I don't think so. You found me instead, and I was crying." "Why were you crying?" "Unless you'd rather not talk about it." "No, I'm happy to talk about it. I was crying because I'd got up late, left the house in a hurry, and I'd forgotten to put on any knickers." I'm not sure what I'd expected in the way of a 50-year-old confession from a strange woman in a public park, but it wasn't this, and I wasn't sure what to say, so what I said was, "Oh, and you were wonderful," said the woman. "Was I? I don't remember ever being wonderful. You said to me, 'That's amazing. I forgot to put mine on as well, so I've decided not to worry about it. The sky won't fall and the sun will still rise.' And that made me laugh and I stopped crying, and, as you can see, I've never forgotten it. In fact, it changed my life." "For the better?" "Oh, yes. Every time something terrible happens, you know, not terrible, terrible, like people dying, but silly, terrible, like losing your PIN number or locking your car keys in the car or not recognising one of your own children, I say to myself, 'Don't worry about it. The sky won't fall and the sun will still rise.' It still works." Like they say on the network news when some politician gets caught with his sticky fingers in the till, it was a defining moment, though I'm not sure what it defined. Until this moment, I was pretty sure I'd never changed anybody's life, and I'd never really wanted to. Teaching technical drawing doesn't change people's lives, especially now drawing is out of fashion and apparently unnecessary when computers will do it all for you. You could argue I'd changed my wife's life when we got married, and again, when she left me under the stress of redundancy and found herself a nice estate agent with a detached house, 2 cars, and 32 teeth. But whether I had changed her life for the better is an open question. As for my grown-up kids, I'd bred them and fed them and not, as far as I could see, screwed them up in any way. My life, as far as I could see, had been a shambles, mainly harmless, but I certainly hadn't transformed anyone apart from this woman I'd met in the park. I told her so. "Thank you for telling me all this," I said. "I just wish I'd taken my own advice. Mind you, I don't remember saying any of it." "Well," she said, "I've had a very nice life. How about you?" I gave her brief, edited highlights of the harmless shambles that constituted the life in question, and then I said, "The more I think about it, the more I realise it wouldn't have made much difference if I'd never existed at all. The sky wouldn't have fallen, and the sun would still have risen." "It's never too late," she said. "To do what?" "To be a contender." When she got up to go, she asked, "Do you often come into the park?" "Only when the dog orders me." "I'll keep my eyes open." Hodges watched her quizzically as she left. He's always been good at quizzically. "Keep your distance," he said. "She'll wheedle her way into your affections, trap you into a late marriage, put poison in your porridge, and inherit your fortune." "Don't be ridiculous. I don't eat porridge." When we got home, we had a more serious talk about the meeting. "What did she mean?" I said. "Never too late to be a contender." "She obviously thinks you should rekindle your youthful ambitions," said Hodges. "Well, too old to play football or cricket or go to the moon. Baldness is genetic. The eyesight isn't good enough for professional snooker. The big bands aren't in fashion. And you can't play the piano." "Thank you for reminding me," I said. "In that case," said Hodges, "it has to be the great novel in the style of D.H. Lawrence about the capitalist hyena who exploited the workers of the town and built the park for you and me." "Are you serious?" "You hunt it, I'll gather it," said Hodges. And then he climbed onto the best armchair and went to sleep.
Cribbins at Christmas, A Walk in the Park with Hodges, was read by Bernard Cribbins, written by Alan Plater, and was a Peer production.